relatively light-hearted lecture in the sense, although you're probably going to wonder what my definition of light is by the end, I suspect. But anyway, I thought I would simply give you a sort of a flavor of some of the other sort of things that can go on in black hole physics with extra dimensions. So to a large extent, I'm not going to go today into great detail, slogging through proofs or whatever. I'm going to give you a little bit of a general discussion about black holes in higher dimensions, and then I'm going to describe the black string instability. I was told that sometimes you ask lecturers to talk about their own research at the end, and although this is a rather old piece of research, I've definitely gone through more recent pieces of research, I thought it'd be kind of cute to tell you about the Gregory-Laflamme instability, since Ray Laflamme is also here at Perimeter. He's now gone off into the quantum world, but nonetheless, I thought that would be quite a nice way to end, so that you see some of the things that people get up to. But to start off with, this is a rather tongue-in-cheek. You've seen the supermassive black hole at the core of the galaxy. This is someone's rendition of what might happen when LHC really gets going. You know, I think these guys could sue J.J. Abrams. You know, I reckon you've seen the new Star Trek is what happens to Vulcan. So. Okay. needless to say, this is utter tosh. So let me just quit that and quit. Okie doke. The purpose behind that video is when we looked at the other video earlier in the course, what we were looking at was a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. So this was a black hole that was millions of solar masses. The CERN black hole is meant to be an absolutely tiny microscopic black hole. So why do people think that you might form one of these tiny black holes when the LHC switches on? What I talked about yesterday with large extra dimensions, remember I was saying that you could have potentially this relation between the Planck mass in higher dimensions and the Planck mass in four dimensions, and that you could produce a hierarchy between our normal gravitational scale in four dimensions, found it, and the Planck scale in higher dimensions. So here we had our Kaluza-Klein scale. That was what I wrote down. And so I was arguing that it was possible to have quantum gravity in higher dimensions much closer to the standard model scale. But of course, if it is very close to the TV scale, then if you actually start colliding particles at energies of 8 or 14 TV, then you might expect to form a black hole. So the picture would be, you have this collision, there's something in general relativity called the Hoop conjecture. Which essentially says that if you can take a hoop I'm putting it here in colloquially here, but it's called the Hoop conjecture because the idea is if you could take a hoop of radius 2gm and just sort of swirl it around your mass in all possible directions, so it's saying the mass is localized within a sphere of size 2gm, then a black hole will form. And so that would be the idea. You could form this black hole, perhaps, in an LHC collision. Of course, that doesn't mean the Earth will get swallowed up. I mean, this is a tiny black hole. And one of the things that I've got you to think about is what the temperature is of black holes. So, I mean, in reality, this thing would just sort of radiate away and disappear. We're in a deeply quantum regime here. So thinking about a classical black hole accreting is perhaps not the right way to go. Also, there's all sorts of debates about whether you would indeed form a black hole, whether that collision, you know, would be as, you know, as clean as I have just indicated. And one thing which I seriously hope you're going to hear about in the numerical explorations course is it's not even clear if you model two incoming particles in a sort of classical gravitational sense, at least so I recall in a talk by Matt Choptiwick, that it's not even clear that a black hole does form or a horizon forms. So the guys doing numerical relativity are sort of looking at colliding these sort of solitony type things together, and they find if you go really, really fast that sometimes these things do seem to just come out the other side. So although this is, note it's a conjecture, people have sort of thought it to be true, but I think I have to put a big question mark here, because if you have things moving highly relativistically, it's not actually clear what you mean anyway by localizing to within 2gm. So I think there could be some interesting developments in this area in the near future, and the developments I think will come from doing numerical relativity rather than, I mean, you can get some insight by looking analytically at the situation. You know, we've looked at taking the black string and speeding it up close to the speed of light, but again, I think the only way to be sure is to actually get in there and do some numerical work. So I hope you'll be sort of hearing about a little bit of that. So going on that theme, what in terms of the actual solid stuff that I'm going to talk about today, I'd like to just give you a little bit of a flavor about perturbation theory. In GR. This is just going to be a flavor. I'll give you some, you know, some formalism and then some waffle. But if you want to think about processes like this and start looking at what the field of a black hole is when you've got extra dimensions, so far, despite a lot of people trying, myself included, nobody actually really knows what the metric is of one of these black holes with large extra dimensions when you have one of these brain worlds. And so what you do is, of course, you model things. One way of modeling is to take a higher dimensional black hole solution and use that to do calculations. Another way to explore the question is to try and do perturbation theory. So perturbation theory in GR is a very useful tool. So I've just given you black holes. Of course, you've already, I think, experienced this, perhaps, you know, in the method of throwing you in at the deep end, I think, because you did the CMB, didn't you? You had a little bit of microwave background in terms of cosmology. I think that might have been kind of ambitious for a first cosmology course. But clearly, when I talked about, gosh, Bruno, if you're saying it's ambitious, it must be. So we talked about cosmology in the terms of brain worlds. And clearly, when I derived that cosmological solution, I made the usual assumptions about homogeneity and isotropy. The universe is not homogeneous and isotropic. We're here, the Earth's here, the Sun's here, the galaxies are here. Lots of structure in the way the galaxies cluster together. So the way we deal with that is we do perturbation theory. The conventional way of attacking this is we say we're very nearly in one of these ideal universes and we're just a little bit away from one. And so that's cosmological perturbation theory. I'm not actually going to do that now, but again, it's just saying perturbation theory is absolutely crucial if you want to apply gravity in physical situations. How did Eddington test Einstein's relativity? He tested it by looking at the bending of light around the sun. And of course, how do you derive that? You do perturbation theory in general relativity. Okay, so all of the ways in which you end up doing gravity in terms of real physics and applying it to the world around us, in the end, it's almost always coming down to perturbation theory. The only time it doesn't is in terms of what people are doing in numerical relativity, trying to find gravitational wave signatures so that the guys at LIGO, and when hopefully LISA goes up, they'll know what they're actually looking at. And because those situations are very strong gravity, strongly dynamic, then you've got to go to a computer. So because it, you know, gravity is devilishly hard to do analytically in sort of real life situations. So perturbation theory. You've got cosmology. Sort of, I suppose, black holes in the sense where you're not actually looking at any strong catastrophic situation, so not really mergers. If you want to think about gravity as a particle theory, so thinking about gravitons, think where else. You've just probably come up with all sorts of lists of different ways you can use them as we go through. So the idea is that we want to talk about a more general manifold and one of these nice, clean, exact solutions. And so what we do is we say that our real metric is equal to our background metric plus a small perturbation. Now, I'm really sorry, because this is just convention, that HAB is always conventionally used for a first fundamental form, and it's always used for a perturbation of the metric. Sorry, it's just the way things are labeled, and I'm just going to stick to that. So for this lecture, H is perturbation. So then obviously what we want to do is we want to think about perturbations of the Einstein equations. We're going to need the Riemann tensor. So if we look at what the variation in the connection is, so if I take the inverse metric, I have to just subtract the perturbation. So I simply replace G with G naught plus H. And again, using this technique of normal coordinates, where I say that, you know, in normal coordinates, all first derivatives of the metric vanish, and then I send my commas to semicolons. I can just see that the variation of the connection is given in terms of a set of derivatives, covariant derivatives, of the perturbation. Yes, because if you took in, this is already to first order in H. perturbation, linearized perturbation theory, you're only ever keeping terms to first order in H. So by implication, this grad is just the G0 grad. So if I want the variation of the Ricci tensor, we've already derived what that is. So again, I'm using this concept about normal coordinates to sort of, you know, when we derive this. So all I do is I now simply take this expression here, plug it into here, and I can just write down. So here I'm taking the first one is grad C of this expression, where now I've got CAB. So inside this bracket, I simply swap my A's and C's. So that's the first one. And then I have to subtract the covariant derivative of delta gamma CCA. But of course, if I contract here on CC, then this, this term here cancels with this term here. And I'm just left with the middle one here. Make sure I get the right one. I've done a naughty up there, haven't I? So notice there, I'd actually put a C at the bottom when it should have been an A. Okie doke. So that's telling me what my variation of delta RAB is. So it's a half grad C, grad A, plus grad C, grad B of H. So this is just symmetrizing on A and B, minus the wave operator of H, Now, if you were in flat space, you could just reverse the order of this differentiation here. And then you would also look at these three terms, and you decide that actually they were just pure gauge, that you could gauge them away. And so if you're in flat space, you would simply end up with box of H. And so the variation of the Einstein equations around flat space, which I think you've already done or at least seen, are that the wave operator of H vanishes. So you deduce that what you get, perturbations around, vacuum perturbations around flat space, satisfy a wave equation, and then you kind of dig in there and you say, okay, now I see that wave equation has two polarizations, that's a gravity wave. So it's quite easy to do in flat space, but we're not going to do easy. We're going to do it in curved space. So what we're going to do is we're still going to try and follow the same, you know, aims. We're going to reverse the ordering of this differentiation so that this covariant derivative with the contraction on the C index is going to be right next to the H. So we're going to sort of end up with the same sort of expression that you gauged away in flat space, but then we're going to look at it in a curved space context. So I have to reverse my differentiation on this. So in order to do that, course, I have to introduce the Riemann tensor when I swap the ordering of covariant differentiation. And remember, when I do that, I take the differentiating indices C and A. They're the last two of the Riemann tensor. I then look at what index I'm replacing. In this case, it's C, and that's in my first slot. And then I replace whatever index I'm contracting on with this dummy index there. So that's the first bit. And then I've got to also do the Riemann identity for the B index. Okay, then the second term here is just the same with A and B swapped. And then I've got my last two terms the wave operator on H and the double derivative of the trace. Okay. So now let me start looking at what these terms are. If I look at this first term here, I can write this as grad A, grad C, HBC. And then I've got the sum adding grad B, grad C, HAC with a factor of a half. So that simply gives me that symmetrized. If I look at the second term, I've got the Ricci tensor here. So this is now going to be R D A H D B. And again, symmetrized on A and B, takes a factor of a half. Now, if I look here, let me just swap this C and D here. So it's that gets me a minus sign. But then, because of the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, H is symmetric, which means I'm symmetrizing effectively here on D and C. So this contraction here is automatically symmetric on A and B. So if I reverse the order of A and B here, I've got the same object. So that takes care of the half. So then I've got minus a half box of H. And then here, I've got minus grad A, grad B of H. So if I pull all this together, yeah, thank you. So pulling all this together, my variation of the Ricci, I've got a half a box, H, I've got twice. Then I've got minus twice of the Ricci term. And then finally, I group these last two pieces together to give me a single term, H bar where what I've done is I've taken my perturbation and I've subtracted half of the trace. So in four dimensions, that would be a trace reversed. That would reverse the trace of H. So this object here is called the Lichnerowicz operator. And so it's the curved space generalization of the wave equation for a spin 2 mode. So let's just look at this. And again, let's re-examine the issue of gauge in general relativity. So as you'll learn in the explorations course, gauge choices are absolutely key in relativity. We've already seen this because we've used them to find the metric of a black hole. We've used them to find the metric of the universe. We've chosen a very special set of coordinates. So I can't emphasize enough just how important gauge choice is in general relativity. And we always choose a gauge to make a problem tractable. And the key advance in numerical relativity was the discovery of a particular choice of gauge, which made the actual coding and the stability of integrations now much better, much more tractable. In that case, it's something called the harmonic gauge. So in this case, I'm not doing numerical relativity. I'm just discussing in general how you might do perturbation theory. And usually, I'm thinking about it at least semi-analytically. So just as a reminder, a gauge transformation in general relativity is a change of coordinates. You can always represent this, at least locally, by shifting your manifold along some gauge field, along some vector field. So your metric will, in general, changes its components, and if the vector field psi is not a killing field, G will change its components, and the amount by which it changes is the Lie derivative of G. So, and so what this is saying is that when you make a gauge transformation, you automatically change your H, your perturbation matrix. So, as you can imagine, just like with normal gauge theory, if you're trying to solve a wave equation and you find a solution, but you know that by simply changing coordinates, you can change an H. You worry when you find a solution, is this physical? Does it mean something? Is it telling me something about what is going on in this situation? So in particular in cosmology, there was a whole hoo-ha about finding gauge invariant variables because you wanted to know whether what you were finding was actually a physical perturbation that was going to do something to your universe. So let's have a look at what happens. This means we've got an H psi. Which is this covariant derivative, symmetrized. So this tells us that our H bar I have to subtract the trace. The trace is just the divergence of psi. So let's have a look at what happens to this term here, the divergence of H bar. Okay, so if I now take the divergence of this expression, I get a wave operator acting on my gauge transformation plus this extra piece. Once again, we'd like to reorder our derivatives there, which we can do at the price of introducing the Riemann tensor. So now I can cancel those terms, but I'm left here with the Riemann. And so I find that box of psi plus the Ricci tensor acting on psi is my change of the derivative of h bar. And so you can show that this actually is a well-posed problem. It's a well-posed set of differential equations, so that if the divergence of h bar is not zero, you can make a coordinate transformation to set it to zero. So we can always choose a gauge if we want. So what that means is that in terms of our Lichnerowicz operator here, this is not really anything physical, this last piece. We know the Riemann and Ricci tensors are, but that term isn't. So let's assume that we have a gauge in which we can cross this out. Is that everything? If we find a solution to what's left, do we have real physics? In order to be sure of that, we've got to ask, is there any residual gauge freedom left? So if we did a gauge transformation, if we added a vector, a small vector piece to our coordinates, then we've got to have this, what I've just computed, has to vanish, okay? Because I'm not allowed to create any components of H which do not satisfy the divergence of H bar equal to zero. And yes, I can find solutions to that. There are n solutions to this equation. For the same reason that if I could always solve that, if that had a source. So this is, of course, in n space-time dimensions. So even when I've done all this, I still don't know that what I've got is physical. So that means, you know, I'm actually going to have to double check things when I get solutions. Or I have to get in the particular problem that I'm dealing with and perhaps look for combinations which are gauge invariant. And that's what you do in cosmology. So let's just do a little bit of counting to see what's left. So HAB was symmetric, and so in n dimensions, that's got n into n plus 1 over 2 degrees of freedom. On the other hand, we've got grad of h bar equals 0. So that gives me n constraints. So now that tells me that I've got n into n plus 1 over 2 minus n degrees of freedom in my H. So I would expect, in general, to find n into n minus 1 over 2 linearly independent solutions to that Lichnerowicz operator. But I know n of them are gauge. So that tells me if I subtract another n, I've got n into n minus 3 over 2 physical degrees of freedom. So that tells me in n equals 4 that I have two polarization states. So these are sort of the cross and, well, whichever way, those are both crosses, aren't they? The plus and the cross polarization states. So this is where your gravity wave, which is quadrupole, you know that it takes a circle and it alternately squeezes it in along one axis while it extends it along the other, and then vice versa. So your circle is for wobbling in and out. And it's either wobbling in and out with this, in this orientation, or at 45 degrees to it. So remember, with vector polarization states, your polarized light is either polarized this way or this way, once you've chosen an axis. It's the same two polarization states, whereas for a 10 spin 2 mode, you've got this or this. In five dimensions, if I look at this, I get five physical degrees of freedom. And you can sort of think of these as being the plus and the cross in terms of two. So in five dimensions, you've got now four spatial directions. And you can sort of think of it as being like a plus. When you've got your graviton moving along, you have no longitudinal degrees of freedom. So just like with an electromagnetic wave, when I said it was either vertical or horizontal, that's in the plane perpendicular to its motion, which is two-dimensional in 4D. In 5D, the space perpendicular to the motion of the graviton is now three-dimensional. And so you can think you've got a plus and a cross in the XY plane, plus a cross in the XZ plane. And you might think you'd get a plus and a cross in the YZ plane, but one of them is just a linear combination of the other polarization states. So you can always kind of get one of the remaining states as a sum of what of all the other things that are left. So you can think of it as plus and cross times two, and then and an additional cross, you know, in the third or something like that. So that's just a little bit about counting of states and degrees of freedom. There's another little thing is if you've got a massless field in n dimensions, you've got these, the number of polarization states of a massless field in n dimensions is the same as the number of polarization states of the massive field in one dimension down. So massive gravitons have five polarization states. So, okie doke. So that would be where you would take a massive graviton, would be where you would take, in my conventions, right? Just like field theory, just add an m squared, box plus m squared phi is zero. So when you're doing Kalitzer-Klein, for example, what we did was we looked at the zero mode, what's called a zero mode, something that is sort of arbitrarily close to zero energy as it propagates. That would be m squared equals zero. In Kalitzer-Klein theory, if you now Fourier decompose any perturbation, with respect to that extra circle, if it has an e to the I mu z, it would pick up a mu squared there. So this would be effectively your Kalitza-Klein modes of gravity give you massive gravitons in four dimensions. So that's your Kalitza-Klein tower. And also, in terms of the Randall-Sundrum, the model that I talked about yesterday, when you do the perturbation theory, again, you see this type of structure cropping up. We talked about the zero mode, but you can also get these massive modes. So one example where you see this is this black string. So remember, the black string is just the Schwarzschild solution. With an extra piece dimension added on. So why might we expect an instability? So we've talked a lot about black hole thermodynamics. So I'm going to use a thermodynamic argument to try and persuade you that this black string has an instability. So we'll take a Kalitza-Klein black hole of length L. So that's this thing, where our z-coordinate now has length L. So we know that our mass is actually R plus times L over 2G5. Alternatively, this would be 2G Newton M in terms of this mass parameter. Let me call that curly M. Over 2G5. But remember I said that when you do Kalitza-Klein theory, you relate the Newton's constants in lower and higher dimensions by factors of the compactification length. This is just m. So now let's look at the entropy. I'll call it S4, but it's obviously a five-dimensional entropy. So the entropy we've shown is a quarter of the area of the event horizon. Well, 1 over 4G5. So we want the area of the event horizon here. So that would be 4 pi r plus squared times L. But I know that R plus is 2 Gn times M. So I can replace this by pi times 2 Gn squared M squared. But again, I know that Gn is equal to G5 over L, so I get 4 pi G5 M squared divided by L. So that's the black string. G5. Yep, G5 this time. Now let me look at a five-dimensional black hole. This is just hyperspherical. It's got radius RS. And the mass, so remember I gave you this formula of Myers and Perry for the mass of a black hole in higher dimensions. So it's d minus 2, so that's 3 in this case. It's the area of a unit 3 sphere, so that's 2 pi squared. And then I've got to take the fall off at infinity. Remember, it's 2 gm on r for Schwarzschild. We wrote it at, it would be rs squared over r squared for the five-dimensional black hole. So that gives me rs squared there. And then I have to divide by 16 pi g. Of course, it's g5. So if I do this, I simply get 3/8 pi over g5 rs squared. So now my entropy. So again, my entropy is 1 over 4g5 times the area. And the area is just 2 pi squared rs cubed. The area of the 3 sphere of radius rs. So here now, I want to replace my rs with m, okay? So I can see I've got to take 8g5 m over 3 pi. And then I have to take the square root to get rs, and then I have to cube it for the entropy, so that's 3/2. And so, I get something which goes like m to the 3/2. So notice that here I've got something that's looking like m to the 3/2. Here I've got something that's looking like m squared with over L. So if I say we know that if something has higher entropy, then it's thermodynamically preferred. So this is going to be preferred when S5 becomes bigger than S4. So if I look at, where's my S4? I've got 4 pi g5 m squared on L. And then on this side, I've got m to the 3/2, g5 to the 1/2, and 8/3 root 2 pi on 3. So I can cancel one of those g5s. Then what I want to write, if I take my square root of L over to the other side, cancel that 4 with that one. This happens when L, root L, is bigger than 3 root 3 over 2 root 2 pi. And then I've got G Newton, and then I've got m to the 1/2 m over m to the 3/2. Now, in order to compare like with like, you should really be comparing things with the same mass. And sometimes, if you're dealing with things in different dimensions, sometimes that can be, you know, you think you know what you're talking about with mass, but actually you've got to be a little careful about what you mean by saying two things have the same mass. Luckily, we're in Kaluza-Klein theory here, so we actually know how to compare like with like. If we look at the black string, in Kaluza-Klein theory, our vacuum is R4 cross S1. And we know how to interpret things at asymptotic infinity because we've reduced, we went through this whole process of reducing the gravitational action on that circle. And so out near infinity, things look like Einstein gravity. We peel off the 1 over r part. And so we've got 2gm over r, and we know that that m is the mass that we would measure as an observer. That would be our ADM mass. So this m here is, in the four-dimensional sense, the mass of the black string. It's a little murkier with this particular case, because if we're in Kaluza-Klein theory, we actually don't expect this. We've got to imagine that our space is compactified, you know, at length L here. And so really what we've got is a whole set, an infinite set of copies of a single hyperspherical black hole. So some people call this a caged black hole. So we don't necessarily expect this five-dimensional Schwarzschild solution to be the exact solution, but we say if L is sufficiently bigger than RS, we would expect it to be, you know, nearby, it would be the five-dimensional solution. As we moved away, we would start to see the fact that we were confined in this extra dimension, but very far away, we should expect exactly the same 1 over r fall off. And so, in fact, this m here really is the same as this m here. And so this is just 1. And so now what I'm seeing here is that if the length of my extra dimension just keeps getting bigger, then eventually I am going to get a situation, should have been a half, I'm sorry. I am going to get a situation where the entropy of the five-dimensional black hole is higher than the entropy of the four-dimensional black hole. So this indicates that there would be an instability. But of course, you know, why would we trust, this is all these arguments about thermodynamics and entropy, we don't necessarily, you know, this sort of seems very odd, or it certainly was odd. Shit, it's 20 years ago, practically, it feels like it. So this was considered very odd. The law was, in the 1980s, black holes were stable. This was what people expected. So how could there be an instability? Well, obviously, you simply, to check this out, you simply have to roll up your sleeves and prove it. So you have to look at this Lichnerowicz operator. So the first thing that you notice is that HAB splits into its irreducible representations with respect to the 4D, the 4D space-time, this 4D metric. So you have an H55, which is like a scalar in 4D. You've got an H5 mu, which is like a vector. And then the H mu nu, which is the tensor. So you looked for an instability. So that means you're looking for something with an exponentially growing mode. You're sitting, you assume it's got some wave in the extra dimension. And for reasons I won't go into, you're just looking for a spherically symmetric perturbation. So let's just look at one bit of it in detail, because it's easy. This is the only bit that's easy. Then if you think about what happens to H55, because all you've done is tacked on an extra dimension, if any of these indices on the Riemann or the Ricci equals 5, you just get 0. So all you have is box H55 equals 0, and that reduces to just the wave operator on a scalar. So this is simply the wave equation for a scalar. So V is the Schwarzschild potential. If we look as R goes to infinity here, we simply pick up minus H55 double primed plus mu squared plus omega squared H55 equals 0. So that just has exponential tail solutions. Which is what you expect. Then as R goes to the event horizon, the Schwarzschild radius, in this case, you pick up this omega squared on V part. So you get H double primed plus H primed over R minus 2gm. And so you find a power law solution. And so the basic idea is if there is a solution, then it has to be regular, physically regular. So that tells you that H has to be proportional to the exponentially decaying solution at infinity. And the decaying solution at the horizon. But then, if you ask what that means you've got, if you sketched H, it would have to go to 0 here, to 0 there. That means it's got to have a maximum. With H double prime negative. Then you look over here and you see if H double prime is negative, this bit's positive. That's 0 because H prime 0. This bit's positive, so you get a contradiction. So there's no solution to H55. And the similar argument sets H5 mu equal to 0. And so then what you do is you look at the tensor mode, H mu nu. So the tensor mode now is purely four-dimensional. And it satisfies one of these massive wave equations. So if there's a solution, it's physical, because all gauge solutions are massless. And to cut a long story short, you do a mountain of algebra, and you find that, sure enough, there is indeed a solution to this equation. And you get a linearized perturbation, which sends your horizon looking something like this. Somewhat exaggerated. So black holes in higher dimensions turn out to be very different creatures to black holes in four dimensions. First of all, they can have all sorts of different topologies. I've just shown you some very simple ones, black strings and black brains. You can actually get some more interesting things. You can get black rings, black Saturns even, believe it or not. You can actually a solution which where the event horizon looks something like Saturn. You've got a black hole in the middle and one of these rings sitting outside it. So they're not stable, those solutions, but nonetheless, you can get a whole host of very different solutions once you go up above four dimensions. So just this theoretical exploration of black holes in higher dimensions turns up quite a rich structure and lots of surprises. So I hope at least, you know, I've given you some pointers and some background to some of the exploration courses. I've told you about gravitational physics. I've talked about black holes, extra dimensions, a little bit about cosmology. And hopefully, I'm going to at least have got some of you to look forward to either the string theory or the numerical relativity or the explorations in cosmology course. Anyway, thanks for being a nice audience. Thank you. Yeah, you didn't expect to get the instability at the end. Well, that's all right. You see, that's your homework for the weekend. You're going to have to actually compute that for the Cherovich operator for HDD.
Just actually say, at what point does it become like a necklace?
Well, that's really the argument. I mean, this is actually something that's very much still open for debate. The numerical guys follow down this instability, and as far as they're concerned, they see evidence that this thing really does pinch off and become individual black holes. Another possibility is that this thing goes to something which is static and non-homogeneous. So again, different numerical guys, depending on whether you, I guess you're elliptic or hyperbolic, actually look to see whether there's one of these static solutions. And they find that there are non-homogeneous type of black strings, but that they're energetically less favored. It costs more energy to make a wrinkly horizon. So it's actually cheaper to sort of follow down the instability here, so to have a dynamical solution. But it's a real worry because, of course, you imagine that there's a singularity somehow going along inside this event horizon. And so if this thing pinches off, you would think that it would look locally like a black hole that's just evaporated and is about to disappear. And so you have an instantaneous naked singularity. And so some people have argued that it doesn't happen in finite time. But, you know, first of all, I don't really think necessarily you can say anything about what a singular structure is inside, although, you know, I think some of the arguments that are used tend to be sort of idealizing the situation that you start with. So it's not even clear what's actually happening inside the event horizon. And it's also possible that the horizon can pinch off in what takes infinite affine time as far as it's concerned, but as far as we're concerned, sitting out here, it takes a finite amount of time. Because remember, time is all relative. You know, we don't necessarily have the same concept of time for someone else. And so for us sitting out here, we could think this occurs in a finite time. So there's not necessarily a contradiction. And I think the entropy argument is really very strongly telling us that this wants to fragment. And again, the whole idea of black holes and thermodynamics, you know, loss of information, there's a lot of little, or not so little, tensions or mismatches when you start applying quantum theory to black holes. So my own sort of feeling is, yes, it probably does split off. But that in itself is a very interesting question within the context of classical general relativity as to how you do that. So.
If one found, say, a gravitational instanton interpolating between a black string and, say, a row of black holes, like an area of black holes, would that be evidence that it does pinch off? I'm coming from a more kind of Euclidean quantum gravity sort of argument. If one could show that such an instanton exists.
Yeah, well, it would be a different mechanism because this is a dynamical evolution.
Right.
So it's it's more like if you wanted to use your Euclidean thing with tunneling, you might be thinking it. I mean, it would be a different way of doing it because we know we can have topology changing transformations when we have instantons in gravity. So that, I think that if somebody found that, that would be interesting because then it would be showing a way, an explicit, what consistent way within the theory itself, within the rules of the game, of actually getting from one state to another state. It may not be what is actually happening here, though, because this is a very strongly dynamical situation. But if there was one of these instantons, then I would find that very interesting because that's, it would be like the, a tunnel, a quantum way of doing some, something that you're not precisely sure how it works classically. So, okay.